fit every mood. If you've just been through a real nasty breakup, you might put Someone Like You by Adele on repeat. If you're singing your baby to sleep, you're going to sing a sweet lullaby like Rockabye Baby. And you're going to wonder in your head, what kind of freak puts their baby in a treetop? And why do we sing this to our children? If you're getting pumped up for the big game, you're going to pump Get Ready by 2 Unlimited. If you just want to rock out, you're going to crank the volume up to 11 and you're going to play some Thunderstruck. Right, Reed? That work? But if you're feeling romantic, you're going to dig out the old vinyl. You're going to drop the lights and you're going to drop the needle on When a Man Loves a Woman. All right? Now, in the same way, the book of Psalms has songs for all kinds of occasions. They have songs to prepare you for worship, right? It's like pre-worship worship. They have songs of wisdom. They had songs of thanksgiving. They even had angry protest songs. They're the imprecatory songs. Israel sang the blues. They had sad songs. The Psalms of Lament. But there is one type of psalm that might be a little unfamiliar to us. They are called the Royal Psalms. Now, the Royal Psalms are songs about, wait for it, royalty. Yeah. Songs about the king. And there are 10 such royal psalms. They are Psalm 2, Psalm 18, 20, 21. 45, 72, 101, 110, 132, and 144. But don't worry, that won't be on the test. But this morning, we want to look at the very first of the royal psalms, Psalms chapter 2. And we want to see how it fits with this overarching story that the Bible is telling us. Now, we have been looking at this overarching story by connecting the dots of 52 of the most important verses of the Bible. And in recent weeks, a couple of the dots that we have connected are all about King David and how King David was not only the greatest king in Israel's history, but through David, God pointed the way to the greatest king, the King of Kings, King Jesus. And Psalm 2, if you're working on a dot-to-dot, you know, and sometimes even without the numbers, you can tell what the next dot's going to be. Well, Psalm 2 fits perfectly with these other dots. But to understand what's going on in Psalm 2, we actually have to begin in 1 Kings chapter 1. So go ahead and open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 1. Now, let me set the scene for you, because there is some real Game of Thrones kind of stuff happening here in the early part of 1 Kings. At this point, David is an old man. His health is failing. Basically, he is on his deathbed. And everybody knows there's going to be a transition of power here pretty quick. But years and years before, David has already designated that the next king of Israel will be his son Solomon. But David has another son. His name is Adonijah. And Adonijah has some ambitions for the throne, and he's very open about it. He flaunts it. But David, in his advanced age and failing health, he's kind of clueless as to what's going on. And in verses 5 through 7, here's what we read. Now, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. His father had never at any time displeased him by asking, "Why have you done less than so?" He was also a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom. He conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar, the priest. And they followed Adonijah and helped him. So David's got this son who's playing the part of a king in order to become king. He rallies strong support. He gets a priest on his side. He goes to Joab, who had been David's favorite military commander. He gets this armed escort to follow him wherever he goes. He's got his own motorcade, and he's not even king yet. And David is clueless this whole time. And what Adonijah does is he calls together all the royal officials and all the royal family, except for those who are loyal to Solomon. And he takes them all to this special place, and they offer sacrifices. And then he is anointed the next king of Israel. Well, the prophet Nathan gets word of what's going on, and he's quite concerned. And so Nathan then goes to Bathsheba, David's wife, Solomon's mother, and says, "Hey, do you know what's going on here? Does David know what's going on here?" And so Bathsheba goes in to see David. Later, Nathan comes in. They explain what's going on to David. And so here's what David has them do. "I want you to take Solomon, and immediately I want you to anoint him the king, and then take him directly to the palace and put him on the throne. No detours, no delays." So that's what they do. Meanwhile, Adonijah and his crew are having a big feast and a big celebration because he's just been anointed king. So they're partying. And while they're having this big party, off in the distance, they hear the trumpet blasts declaring that Solomon is now the king of Israel. And at this point, Adonijah's allies realize the jig is up. And so they all head off to their own places, you know, trying to act and pretend like nothing's going on. I wasn't a part of that. Adonijah himself flees to the temple. He clings to the altar. And he says he won't let go unless his brother swears to spare his life. And that's how Solomon becomes king, after narrowly escaping a coup attempt by his own brother. Now, what does all of this have to do with Psalm 2? You can flip over there to Psalm 2 now. Most Bible scholars believe that not only is Psalm 2 a royal psalm, a psalm about the king, but specifically this song was used at the coronation of Solomon. And what's important about this psalm and our core verse this morning is that it refers back to 2 Samuel chapter 7. That's the passage that we looked at, I think, 3 Sundays ago. And in that passage, God makes a promise to David to be a father to his son. And Psalm 2 refers back to that promise. Now remember, in Bible prophecy, it's like a picture where there's one thing in the foreground, but there's something even bigger in the background. And the picture in the foreground here is King Solomon. But the even bigger picture in the background is King Jesus. Now what we see here in Psalm 2 is God's response to all of these shenanigans that are going on. And God's first response is laughter. He laughs at Adonijah's maneuvering for the throne. The psalm opens talking about how the people are plotting and conspiring against the Lord's anointed. And then in verse 4 it says, "But the one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them." So he looks down and there's all these little power plays for this little throne on earth. But the one who sits on the throne, the ultimate throne, he laughs at them. They plot and they scheme in vain. And just like Adonijah trying to steal the throne from his brother, all of these power plays mean nothing. Nothing to God. Now here's a good spot to press the pause button and expand this beyond Adonijah just a little bit. What about our own petty power plays? How often do we try to position ourselves to our greatest advantage? To make ourselves look good. Right? We put things on social media to make us look better than we really are. To make our lives look more exciting than they really are. We take 15 selfies just to pick the one that makes us look good, and we crop it just so, and we apply three different filters on it because we want everyone to have a certain image of us. We hammer out an email that paints somebody else in the worst possible light just so that we look better by comparison. How is that really any different from Adonijah running around with his little entourage acting like he's going to be king when he isn't? How often does God look down on our petty little games of one-upsmanship and just silly people? And how silly is it? All the energy and effort and expense that we put into propping ourselves up just to say, hey, look at me. And so God laughs. As we move further down the psalm, God responds by enacting his plan despite what everyone else does. In other words, God goes ahead and does what he was going to do anyway. We see this in verses 6 and 7, and this is where we get to this week's core verse. And this week's core verse is so easy. It's not even the whole verse. It's just part of a verse. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. All right, you've already memorized it, see? You are my son. Today I have begotten you. But I want to read this in context, verses 6 and 7. As for me, this is God speaking, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. Mount Zion, that's where Jerusalem was. I will tell of the decree the Lord said to me. You are my son, today I have begotten you. So God here is fulfilling in part the promise he made in 2 Samuel chapter 7 to be a father to David's son. He's saying, I am your father. You are my son today. And what's interesting about this language, it's almost lifted word for word right out of an ancient adoption ceremony where a dad would be adopting a son and the father would declare, I am your father, you are my son. And so not only is God, in a sense, adopting Solomon as his son, he is now including him into his covenant with King David and making him a child of the promise. Now, if this is where it ended, it would be cool. I mean, we could look at it and we could say, look, God keeps his promises. He is faithful. He does exactly what he says he's going to do. And so you can trust him. And that would make a pretty good sermon in and of itself. But here's the thing. This isn't where it ends. It gets so much bigger. You see, this psalm isn't just about the coronation of Solomon or any other earthly king, but it is about the coronation of the ultimate king, the King of Kings, King Jesus. You see, this psalm is what we call a messianic prophecy, a predictive foretelling of Jesus, the Messiah. And there are some clues right inside the psalm that should tell you, I think this psalm's about something bigger. First clue, in verse 2, when it talks about the rulers of earth setting themselves against the Lord's anointed, the Hebrew word for anointed there is the word Messiah, which means anointed one. That's a pretty good clue. It's talking about the Messiah. Clue number 2 comes in our core verse, verse 7. Not only does God adopt Solomon as his own son by saying, you are my son, but he adds this, I have begotten you. Today I have begotten you. Maybe your version says, today I become your father. Now this word begotten is used when a man physically impregnates a woman or when a woman gives birth to a child. It means that you physically come from me. You are a part of me. Now, this simply could be a poetic way of saying, I'm going to love you like you're my own son. I'm going to love you like you're my own flesh and blood. But I think it's more than that. When you turn to the New Testament, specifically when you get to probably the most famous verse in the entire Bible, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that He gave His one and only Son. And how many of us remember that in the old King James or maybe the New American Standard? For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. Now that doesn't mean that God is literally Jesus' Father. What it means is that I sent Jesus. He came from me. He is of me. He is of the same divine essence as me. Clue number three. There are some things in this psalm that don't quite fit Solomon, but they fit Jesus perfectly. The opening verses of Psalm 2 talk about how the nations rage and the peoples plot and the kings and the rulers of the earth set themselves against the Lord and His anointed. And this doesn't quite fit Solomon because in his case, the people that were going against him, it wasn't the nations. It wasn't the kings of the earth. It was his own brother and his fellow kin and countrymen. But it fits Jesus. Herod, the local king. Pilate, the Roman governor representing the emperor in faraway Rome. Jewish religious leaders. Roman soldiers. And make no doubt, Roman soldiers mostly didn't come from Rome. But they came from nations all over the empire, sometimes nations outside of the empire. Jesus was literally opposed by the nations. And in the century since, how many armies have marched against Him? How many kings have banned Jesus? How many nations have outlawed His words? How many rulers have tried to slam shut the door on the church? All in vain. You get down to verses 8 and 9. They promised that the coronated king would have authority and power over the nations, and the king would rule over them with a rod of iron all the way to the ends of the earth. That never happened under King Solomon. Now, certainly Israel defeated all of her enemies. They had influence over all of the nations around them, but Solomon never reigned over a global kingdom. But do you know who does? And do you know who will? In Revelation 7, 9, and 10, John has a vision. Here's what he sees. After this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And you know who the Lamb is? Jesus. He is the one that sits on the throne over the nations. You see, Solomon doesn't fit the bill. He's kind of like a cardboard stand-in. But it's going to take somebody bigger and better than Solomon. And even before Jesus came, Jewish rabbis and teachers taught that Psalm 2 was a messianic prophecy. It was predicting the coming Messiah. Now, I want to show you what happens when we get to the New Testament. This is pretty cool. The New Testament is filled with quotes of the Old Testament. There's about 850 quotes and allusions of the Old Testament in the New. Out of all the Old Testament passages quoted in the New Testament, no passage is quoted as much as Psalm 2. In fact, about 60% of Psalm 2 is quoted in the New Testament directly or indirectly. That's pretty cool. Now, the first time is in Matthew chapter 3. at the baptism of Jesus. You remember the story. John the Baptist is out in the wilderness preaching the good news. He's baptizing people, not in the same baptism we just did, but in a baptism of repentance. And Jesus comes to John to be baptized. And John says, "Oh, no, I'm not worthy to baptize you. In fact, you should baptize me." But Jesus insists. And so John baptizes Jesus, and here's what happens. Immediately he went up from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and coming to rest on him. And behold, a voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." Now, literally, word for word, it says, "You are my Son, my beloved." God himself quoting Psalm 2, "You are my Son," and applying it to Jesus. That's a big deal. And it wasn't just John the Baptist that heard this, but it was everybody there. The same thing would happen again in about 2 years. Jesus took three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, said, "Hey, come with me." And they go up on this mountain. We don't know what mountain it was, so we just call it the Mount of Transfiguration. And there up on the mountain, it's like Jesus says, "Hey, you want to see something really cool? Here's what I really look like." And for a few moments there, his veil of humanity is lifted. And they see Jesus not as a human, but they see him in all of his divine glory, not as the Son of Man, but as the Son of God. And it says that his face shone like the sun, and that his clothes blazed in brilliant white. And it's such an overpowering experience. Peter becomes this blithering idiot. He starts talking nonsense. But then again, there is this audible voice out of heaven, God himself speaking, and he quotes those same words, "You are my Son, my beloved," quoting Psalm 2. Then we get to the early church in the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 4, two of those three disciples that saw Jesus up there and heard those words, "You are my Son," they're arrested for speaking publicly about Jesus. And the official said, "Hey, we told you not to speak in that name anymore." And they said, "We've got to obey God rather than men, so fooey on you." So they beat Peter and John and then let them go. And they're like happy about it. Like, "Hey, we got beat in the name of Jesus, all right." They go back to the church and they tell everybody what happened. And so they all get together and they have this impromptu prayer meeting. And in their prayer, they quote the first three verses of Psalm chapter 2. Talking about the nations raging and the rulers of the earth going against God's anointed. And they apply it to Jesus. It says, "For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel." Later on in Acts chapter 13, this time it is the Apostle Paul. He is speaking and he quotes our core verse in verse 33. I'll begin in verse 32. "And we bring you the good news that what God promised to our fathers, this he has fulfilled to us, their children, by raising Jesus, as it is also written in the second Psalm." So Paul here says he's quoting Psalm 2. "You are my Son, today I have begotten you." Then we get to the book of Revelation and the second coming of Jesus. And verse 9, where it talks about the authority and the power of God's anointed one and how he will rule the nations with a rod of iron, that verse is quoted three separate times in Revelation, and each time it refers to Jesus. Now consider this. Psalm 2 is just one of many messianic prophecies in the Old Testament that foretell Jesus. There are over 300 messianic prophecies that talk about Jesus in the Old Testament. Now, admittedly, some of them are kind of vague, like, well, that could be Jesus, but that could be somebody else too. But many of them are very specific. In fact, here are just some of the specific major prophecies you will find in the Old Testament. Micah 5:2, where Jesus would be born. Isaiah 53:3 through 5, how Jesus would die. Zechariah 11:12, the price of his betrayal. Zechariah 9:9, that Jesus would enter Jerusalem riding on a donkey. Isaiah 7:14, Jesus would be born of a virgin. All of these prophecies made hundreds of years in advance. And when you take them all together, it proves that Jesus is exactly who he said he was. Now, years ago, there was a guy by the name of Peter Stoner. He was a mathematics professor, and he wrote a classic book on apologetics, which is just a fancy word for a defense of the Christian faith. This book was called Science Speaks. Now, I do not encourage you to go to Amazon when you get home and order this book, Milan. Don't do it. Is you're writing it down? Well, you can do it, but the last time I checked, it's an out-of-print paperback, and it'll set you back about $140. So, but one of the cool things in this book is that he calculates the odds that any one person in human history could fulfill just 7 messianic prophecies. And he figures the odds at 1 in 100 quadrillion, that is 10 to the 17th power. Let's just say for my bad math brain, it's a really big number. All right? But Stoner does a good job of helping us visualize this really big number. He says, if you take the state of Texas, which if you've ever driven across Texas, is a really big state, okay? You cover the whole state in silver dollars, 2 feet deep. All right? And then you take one of those coins, you paint it red, you throw it back in, and you mix them all up. All right? Then you get a volunteer, you blindfold them, and you set them loose in the state of Texas, and you tell them you can pick up one coin, and it has to be the red one. The chances that that volunteer picks up that coin the first try is the same mathematical probability that any one person could fulfill just 7 of the messianic prophecies. Now, Jesus doesn't fulfill just 7 of them. He fulfills all of them. More than 300 of them. That's what Jesus does. And so I want you to rest assured this morning that not only do you have reason to believe, you have very good reason to believe. I want you to have confidence in your faith. There are too many people that think that when you become a Christian, you have to turn your brain off. All right, that's not true. You do not turn your brain off. In fact, I believe that faith turns your brain on. It is not a leap into the illogical. In fact, when you consider the power of fulfilled prophecy, believing is really the only thing that makes sense. Now, I know that some of us struggle with our faith, that we have doubts, that we have questions, and I want you to know that's okay. I believe God's grace is big enough to handle our questions. We're in the Psalms right now. If you read through the Psalms, you're going to find there's a lot of questions. How many times does David say, why? Why, God? Why have you forsaken me? And God doesn't strike him with lightning bolts. It's okay. And I believe our reasons to believe are strong enough that they can stand up against our doubts. And I believe that in every journey of faith, anyone who sets out to follow Jesus are going to have times where they feel just like the dad we read about in Mark chapter 9. There is this father, and he has a son who is demon-possessed. And he has heard stories about Jesus and what he can do, and that he even frees people from demons. And so this frantic father comes to Jesus with his son, and he pleads. Here's what he says. He says, "If you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus responds, "If you can, all things are possible for the one who believes." And this desperate daddy cries out, "I believe! Help my unbelief." And how often has that been the cry of my own heart? Yes, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. How often has that been the cry of your heart? I believe. Help me with those times I don't believe. We all have those moments. Psalm 2 and all of the other messianic prophecies, these fulfilled promises, are there to help your unbelief. Another thing we can take away from these fulfilled prophecies is that we can have confidence that Jesus will do for us exactly what he said he will do for us. If he is exactly who he said he is, then we can trust that he will do exactly what he said he was going to do. And what he said he was going to do is that he has gone to prepare a place for us. I can believe that because of 300 and some fulfilled messianic prophecies in the Old Testament. We have hope in heaven. Jesus is everything. Everything he claimed to be. He is the bread of life. He is the light of the world. He is the door. He is the resurrection and the life. He is the good shepherd. He is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the true vine. He is the King of kings. He is the Lord of lords. There's no doubt. There's no question except for this question. Jesus is all of those things, but who is he to you? Who do you believe Jesus to be? We're going to stand and sing. And if you need to pray or make a decision much like we saw here just a few minutes ago this morning, we have people to pray with you up here at the cross, in the back. I'll be over here at these double doors. Who is Jesus?